I started with that poem, part of a poem by Wallace Stevens, the American, I'm very American, American poet. It's a long poem. The part I read earlier was the final section of a long poem called An Ordinary Evening in New Haven. I got very excited because I actually went past New Haven on the coach. I thought, oh, that's a really ordinary evening in New Haven. But it was very long. And I was already at Yonkers by the time, you know. So it's this massive poem, it's 31 sections, finishes with that. It is not in the premise that reality is a solid. It may be a shade that traverses a dust, a force that traverses a shade. Yeah, beautiful conclusion. And it's interesting, it's a late Stevens poem, so he was very quite elderly then, quite depressed. He had a very difficult marriage. He's a very buttoned up kind of man. He worked in insurance all his life. He was a surety salesman and became an national expert on surety bonds. He would walk to work in Hartford, writing poems in his mind. Then he'd be in, you know, these meetings all the time with his secretaries and doing surety bonds. And surety bonds are apparently incredibly detailed work. And occasionally he would pause in his dictation and write down something and carry on with his dictation. And on the way home would write in his mind and then go to his room. And so, you know, I read a biography recently. There's very little to say. He just went to work and then went up to his room and wrote these poems. A lot of people he worked with didn't even know he wrote poems, you know. His work was incredibly kind of literal and, you know, factual and blah, blah, blah. And then he had this incredible, almost baroque imagination. And the two never seemed to touch. Didn't have anything much to do with the poetry world either. But I really like that sentence. It is not in the premise that reality is a solid. Obviously he's been influenced by Einstein and so on, new thinking, that it is not in the premise. In other words, it's not a given that reality is a solid. Yeah. And you could, you know, use that sentence as a sort of the basis for this whole seminar. It is not in the premise that reality is a solid. It may be a shade that traverses a dust, a force that traverses a shade. So that's his questioning of what, and all of his life, all of his poems are about questioning about what reality is. It is not in the premise that reality is a solid. And that's what Buddhism is doing. It's questioning about what reality is. Yeah. But I want to start, if I can, with us, as it were, and then try and talk about our human situation a bit. I don't know where I'm going with this, let's see. He's making it up. where we are, as it were, and then see if I can take us towards enlightenment, at least in imagination. and then we'll have a try and finish with something that is something you can think about and put into practice in your life to some degree. Otherwise, it's pretty fruitless, isn't it? You're not trying to just theorise about things. And then we'll finish with a little meditation. So the place I wanted to start is this experience I have of myself, and I'm hoping that you'll empathise with me, which is this experience of, golly, who am I? What am I? Am I a nice person or a horrible person? Am I this kind of person or that sort of person? When I was younger, I used to think, am I left wing or right wing? In those days, very left wing, or thought I was. Things happen to me and I find myself responding in ways that I really didn't expect and didn't think of myself. For instance, you know, a while ago now, I remember losing my temper, and it's very, very unusual for me to lose my temper. It's not something that happens to me, not because I'm terribly saint-like, it's just that my aggression tends to be internalised. I tend to do it towards depression rather than anger and rage and so on. One theory of depression is it's internalised aggression. You know, instead of aggression coming out, it goes inwards, you know, and depresses you. And that's much more my habit. So it was really quite shocking to find myself lose my temper. And I lost my temper like that. you know, I was on the phone to somebody, before I knew it, I was shouting. It was really, really unheard of for me. And, you know, that shock of thinking, where did that come from? What was that about? Or, I've told the story many times, but, you know, when my partner's oldest daughter, Alex, when she was about 3, I was carrying her, and somebody kind of bumped into us or came a bit close to us. And I really felt this wolfish protection. You know, I nearly bared my teeth at this person, you know. I would have done a lot to protect this child. I mean, what struck me about it was it just in a slightly crowded place, and the person didn't mean to knock into her. I was carrying her. No, and the person didn't mean to knock into us. And of course, they weren't thinking, who shall I knock into? That guy looks. You know what I mean? Funny, isn't it? When people knock into you, then why are people knocking into me? But they're not knocking into you. They're just knocking into someone. You happen to be that someone, that's all. They don't sort of think, hey, the grey guy, he's the one to knock into. But what struck me is even, I think we were at an art gallery, something was a genteel event, that to feel this kind of wolf-like instinct to protect, which, you know, as far as I didn't expect to have children in my life, I never expected to experience that, didn't know I had it in me. So, you know, we think of ourselves as, well, this is myself, and we use, this is me, this is myself, very naturally we use I as if we could draw on a chalkboard a line around in a, you know, a circle, and then put all the bits of I in that circle, and then suddenly you lose your temper, or you suddenly discover yourself in this kind of incredible protective mode, or you get terribly frightened, or you get I don't know, just that the situations bring the worst out of you. Actually, what we mean by ourselves when we refer to ourselves, which we do casually on a day-to-day basis, as if we actually know ourselves. As you try to work with that experience, and that's the experience that Buddhism is mainly pointing us to, is your direct experience of yourself. As you try to work with that, it becomes not always clearer and clearer. There is an element of that, without doubt, but it also becomes more and more mysterious. One discovers that one is a particular kind of creature, and it's very difficult to know how much of that kind of creature can change or not. Bhante Sangharakshita, the founder of this movement, he once said that it's the contents of your mind that changes, not the structure. But how do we know the difference between structure and content? You know, so for instance, I'm an extroverted thinker. I think out loud. I find it quite difficult, you know, like when I try to prepare for an evening like this, I did go for a little walk and try and think about it. I just sort of don't do it like that. Manjusir, a good friend of mine, he does it all like this. He does it all, but he's very, very internal. We're like chalk and cheese. Sometimes we swap over. He's chalk and cheese, I'm cheese and he's chalk. You know, his mind is very interior in a certain sort of way, whereas I think out loud and I think on the hoof and I change my mind as I'm thinking, you know, which gets me into terrible trouble sometimes, as you can imagine. I find that I can't very easily change that. I can discipline myself not to do it, but as soon as I relax, I start acting like that again. You know, you can't just will yourself to change the structure. You find that you're a particular kind of creature. You can have cherished ideas about yourself and then have to realise that that's not really you. A friend of mine very, very much thought of himself as an artist or a writer. And he's had to have sort of painfully come to terms with the fact that it's just not really him, it's an idea about himself. So you can have ideas about yourself that are wrong, you can have outside ideas about yourself that are right. So even on that level, this sense of ourselves is very mysterious. But also, of course, it's not just our own business. So we're shaped by historical forces. We're shaped by people's attitude to us. You know, there's that old saying, give a dog a bad name and hang it. If people treat you in a particular way, you very easily conform to it, instinctively, without quite noticing. So if people think of you as a troublemaker, before you know it, you make trouble, which confirms they were right to think of you as a troublemaker, which confirms your feeling of being boxed in, so you may as well make trouble, you know. How do you free yourself from that? We're sort of created not just by our sense of ourselves and our own mysterious kind of structure, and we do seem to come into life, don't we, with a particular structure. I mean, I've got three older brothers and a younger sister, and, you know, my brothers, you know, we look like photocopies of each other, particularly two of them. One of them, people think that, you know, I've gone round and, you know, appeared in another way, a bit beefier. You know, you know, he's a much swearier version of me, but, you know, we look very similar, but our attitudes of life are quite different, our paths of life are quite different. So how does one work out the kind of creature you are from the inside, but also that creature you are from the inside is met by historical forces, social forces, interaction with others, which brings out certain things in us, and doesn't relate to certain things in us, you know. And if you're not careful, your life can be bounded by that. You know, when my mother, she got married to my father, you know, she's very much, the assumption was that what she wanted was just to have a family, and you know, she went about that with some gusto, at least somebody did. there we are. Then, you know, we all went, and then she didn't know who she was without having five children in the house. You know, she was 19 when she met my father, so she couldn't remember, and anyway, she was, you know, that was a long time ago, she couldn't remember who she was anymore. It was like a terrible shock to her. And of course now, I remember one of my embarrassing stories is when I was young, I bought a Fat is a Feminist issue for Christmas. Really, really bad choice. Do not buy that. I mean, how unfortunate. Anyway, you know, I still cringe at that. You know, I was trying to turn her into a feminist and try to, and that was sort of, in those days, sort of anti-mother, that, you know, if you were a mother, well, that wasn't enough, you know, having five children wasn't enough. You had to do, I don't know, you had to go to Mars or something, you know, or become a boxer. But, you know, she actually, that was what she wanted to do, you know, and that was trying to argue her into some sort of thing. Anyway, there you go. Let's not drag all those. That's rather sad, though. You know how you try to improve your parents and, because you don't actually know them, but you've got something you think is going to really sort them out at the age of 17, you know, having been world weary. But it is mysterious, isn't it, that we have to work out the kind of creature we are. That's tricky enough as it is, but that creature is always coming into contact with other creatures who are trying to work out the kind of creature they are, who misunderstand each other very easily, who disagree very easily, who find it difficult to disagree. You've also got these strange historical pressures which open some potentials for you in any given moment and close down others. You know, how does one find one's freedom? What does one do, you know? And, you know, Buddhism, what we've tried to call Buddhism and unfortunately call, is trying to say, well, it's mostly saying the key to that is your own experience of your own consciousness. It's not saying it's all to do with your own consciousness, although it puts so much weight in that it could be mistaken to be saying that. It's not saying that everything that you experience is to do with your mind. Sometimes it gets, like karma, sometimes gets absurdly translated like that. It's not saying that. It's saying something much deeper and something much more difficult, which is that the kind of life you experience has some dynamic relationship with the kind of mind you have. So the way to flourish your life, the way to make the most of your life, is to work directly, or as directly as you can, with your mind, with your mental states. It's not then saying that and everything will be lovely, or all your pain will go away, or, I don't know, we all agree on stuff. It's just saying something much more pragmatic, like there's all of these millions of people and there are, you know, history and politics and society and changes of culture, massive changes that we're all swept along by. Jung thought that we were the toys of the gods in the Greek sense. I'm really struck by that, that we were the toy of the gods. In other words, that all kinds of impersonal forces, both actually weirdly personal and historical and social, are sort of blowing through us. We're toys of the gods. He actually thought that's what had happened to the gods, that they'd gone from being external, animating creatures of nature into what we call the unconscious, these forces that blow through us. And one of the things we're trying to do with meditation, for instance, is learn how to work with those forces without taking them personally, without getting caught up in the perspective of those forces. Because you know what they're like, they're forces of hatred, they're forces of greed, they're forces of delusion, they're forces of anxiety. Anxiety is it's infectious, isn't it? In fact, all mental states are infectious. You can infect a whole culture with anxiety. You can infect a whole culture with hatred, as you saw in Nazi Germany. States of mind are infectious, yeah? So what we're starting with, as it were, is very, very mysterious. We have to work out the kind of creature we are. In relationship to other people, you have to work out the kind of creature they are. Amongst these forces of history and society that aren't really to do with us, but in which we're caught in. And meditation is trying to say, Buddhism is trying to say, that the point of freedom, place of growth, is your consciousness, what you yourself are making of your life. Yeah. And as soon as you think about your consciousness and what you're making of your life, without knowing, you're talking about value. As soon as you think about your life at all, in any valuable way, i.e. apart from how much money do I get, when do I get to sleep with somebody, when do I get a promotion, when do I get a flat, all of those sort of relatively trivial things, what my career and so on, they're quite trivial really. As soon as you try and think about your life, you're trying to get to grips with this problem of value. What do I, which becomes something like, what do I move away from that's not valuable, that's not helpful, that's not growthful, it's not serving my best interests? And to serve one's best interests, you're trying to serve the best interests of those around you. How do I get away from the things that aren't doing that towards things that are doing that, you know, towards real values that serve my own best interests and the best interests of those around me, not just the sort of group that we belong to, but the many people, as Buddhism would say, so how do I move from less value to more value, from less fulfillment to more fulfillment, from less meaning to more meaning? Human consciousness has got that written into it. I don't think there's a way around that. Some people will try and say there is, forget all that, just party. Some of my friends, that seems to be their answer. Seems to be, at the moment, this historical moment, it seems to be festivals, doesn't it? Just do festivals. It seems to be mainly get naked at some point, possibly as you go in, sometimes all the time when you're in there, at least at some point you have to get naked, which is means it's a youth thing, because for some of us it's not a good sight. Anyway, take drugs or not take drugs, sway around a lot, and then recover from that during the week, and then go to the next festival. So that is one response to the mysteries of life. It's very time-bound. It won't be a good look when you're my age, I can tell you. But, you know, we're all trying to, more or less coherently, and even when you go into a festival, you're doing that, you're trying to more or less coherently move from less value to more value. Even put more sort of crudely, less life to more life. That's why people go to festivals. It's not because, I don't know, they want more life. And we all want more life. I've been very struck by this just recently. I was talking in America, and I was thinking about that more and more, that, you know, we want to fully express ourselves. It's not that we want to, it's written into our nature to fully express ourselves. I was talking about this in New Hampshire. I've always wanted to go to New Hampshire because I'm a great fan of Robert Frost, who lived most of his life in New Hampshire. In fact, I was only an hour away from his house. I was very tempted to go, but didn't have time. It's lovely being in New Hampshire because, you know, you're surrounded by woodland. It's completely different. And like there's lots of oaks, but they're great big long tall ones, not big fat ones. And they come right up to the house, it seems to me. So that your sense of nature in New Hampshire is utterly different to anything I've experienced in England. Nature kind of is massive, and it's got lots of bugs in it, I tell you. You know, you don't see those on the photographs, but anyway, they were all waiting with knives and forks when I waked up, you know, and started with my legs. Anyway, there we go. But the different meaning of nature, you know, sort of incredibly fecund, you know, sort of very, very, I loved it, I thought it was beautiful. And I was saying, you know, these trees want to be as tall as they can. They want, all of them wanting to get up there and get to the sky and get to the sunlight. And then that leaves other things their chance to grow the bit that they can. And the grass wants to just be a blade of grass, you know. And I was saying to them, you know, I come from England where an oak tree in the middle of the field just wants to do that incredible oak tree thing, you know, where it wants all of that space to spread out in all directions. Apparently they sustain more life than any other tree, don't they? Incredibly more. You know, they just want to do that oak tree thing, like, really do it, you know, really, like, do it, and be hundreds of years old, you know, fantastic. And that's not because they're thinking, what should I do with my life? I feel like being an oak tree, you know. What ideology do I have? They just want to, they want to fully express their oak tree-ness. We human beings, I think, are exactly the same. We want to fully express our humanity. But of course, as Kuhn's use have this word humanity, we don't know what it is. It's fine with an oak tree, because you can say there's an acorn and there's an oak tree. Good heavens, would you imagine that that can become that? You know, we're outside of that, so that we can say, yeah, that's all very well being an acorn, they have a shiny little acorn, you know. But that acorn can become that incredible thing in the middle of a Welsh field or an English field, that big hundreds of years old oak tree. Because we're standing outside of that, we can see that. But we don't have a place in which we can stand outside of us and see us. So we can't judge what it means to be human, because we haven't got another vantage point. It's presumably why we invented God. We need another vantage point to look at us and say, yes, you've got a shiny little small thing there, but you can do this. Yeah. But actually, we invented God to try and get round that problem. You know, the Bible says we're made in the image of God. I really like that metaphor, actually, that mankind is made in the image of God, that we have within us a portion of the immortal soul that is God. You know, we're made in God's image. I think it's a very valid metaphor. I take it metaphorically. It's an incredible metaphor about the sovereignty and majesty of human consciousness, that we're made in the image of God. It's a metaphor for that, isn't it? But you see how we can look at an oak tree and see what it can be. We can look at a kitten and see what it can be. We can see a little lemur and see what it can be. But there's no place to look at the human and see what it can be. Yeah. Which, when you think of it, is really odd. So we don't know what we are in that metaphysical sense. So, you know, this is the Buddhist vision of, you know, the oak tree to the acorn, really. This is the Buddha figure, enlightenment, is that fullest fruition of the human. It's trying to say, this is the oak tree to our acorn. Yeah? Wherever we are, and that, whether we've got a few roots going down or break that beautiful glossy shell and just have that pale green root going down to the earth, and we need all those conditions to grow. This image, and any image of the Buddha, is trying to say that it can grow into this kind of majesty. I'm really glad that at Vajrasana, our retreat centre, we've got a really much larger Buddha figure. You know, I hope that in the future we'll get even, you know, a bigger retreat centre within a much bigger one, because you want this picture of majesty, of glory. That's what Buddhism is saying about your experience, is that you can grow into this. Because as soon as you say the human, a growth in the human, you're saying two things. You're saying, firstly, not the supernatural. Yeah? So as soon as you're talking about growth in the human, you're saying not the supernatural. So we don't mean that we're going to sprout wings and become an angel. We're not going to go to heaven, at least not as we understand it. We're not talking about God or gods. There's nothing supernatural in Buddhism. But the trouble with that is you then think the human, then you think you know what the human is. Like you might think you know what an acorn is if you only knew acorns. Do you see what I mean? We're in a position to see what can happen to an acorn. There's no one in a position, apart from the Buddha traditionally, who can see what can happen to us. So when we say human, we erroneously think we know what we mean. But we've got no one who can stand outside the human saying, actually, it can mean this. So we don't know how deep human goes. Do you see what I mean? We have no conception of how deep human goes. We have no conception of it on the simply practical level. I've been using this a lot because I've been reading Marilynne Robinson, who's a very great, I think, very impressive Calvinist thinker. I think she's a marvellous novelist. Not all of my friends agree. I think she's a major novelist. I was talking about it in America, so I was assuming they'd all read her, but nobody seemed to have hardly heard of her. She's really, really remarkable. But, you know, she's saying nobody knows the limit of human consciousness. You know, she uses the issue of the sciences. They start in the Renaissance with that incredible flourishing of science, you know, coming, that comes out of wonder. If we could then tell them now that we've, go back to Shakespeare's time and tell them that we've now sent a spacecraft, whatever they're called, out of our solar system, it would seem unbelievably magical. You know, like magic. You know, if we could say to Shakespeare, we can now travel under the ground, you know, and go home under the ground, under a city, it would be like magic. Or we can talk to somebody on the other side of the world, holding this kind of plastic thing. So there's no known, even on that simple level of what human beings can do with their mind, never mind transcendence yet, we don't know how much more we can do. I mean, already we've outstripped the wildest fantasy of those early scientists, completely outstripped it. So on that level we don't know, and we don't know on terms of how deep the human mind runs. So when we talk about the human, we don't know how deep it runs. We really don't. We think we do, but we don't. I was really struck by this particularly because I interviewed a poet, Don Patterson, and he was saying, look, there's nobody here but us chickens, which I think is a pop song. There's no one here but us chickens. And it sounds very... He thinks of himself as a Buddhist. You know, and a very good poet, and a very, very impressive man, I thought. But I was struck by that. You know, he thinks of himself as either influenced by Buddhism or a Buddhist, and he said, well, there's no one here but us chickens. In other words, he's saying, this is it. If you're not careful, you're saying a really existing self in a really existing world, no one here but us chickens, so let's get better at being really, you know, well, good chickens, happy chickens, chickens in a good relationship with other chickens. And it sounds so grown up, doesn't it? And unabashed and unfantasized and unromanticized. It sounds very adult. There's no one here but us chickens. There's no supernatural. So let's just get on with that. But Buddhism's not saying that. Buddhism would want to say, how do you know? How do you know? That's just an assumption. You can't possibly know that. You know, Buddhist meditation can take you into places which you would describe as mystical. In the fully developed sense, which you would struggle to be able to put any words to, that you wouldn't believe that you could experience. We don't know that there's nobody here but those chickens. You know, that's actually a presumption. We're mistaking beliefs for facts. We think we know what happens when we die. We don't know what happens when we die. We don't even know what the mind is. I was talking to a nuclear scientist who comes along to the Oxford group and was on a retreat. You know, and this is a nuclear scientist, so it's not like somebody who just does a bit of WWW, you know, not like, you know. He's a nuclear scientist. He said, no, absolutely not. You know, and science has got no idea about the mind. It can show you how neurons light up certain parts of the brain, but it's completely has no idea about how this is possible. It's a massive issue, you know. And he's a man who spent his life in, I think, nuclear fission rather than fraction. But anyway, I was really struck by that. So what we're always doing is moving towards value. And what Buddhism is saying is that the Buddha is the great value. Enlightenment is the great value. And what Bhante is trying to say is enlightenment an experience or not? We'll come on to this as we go on through the seminar. And... He spends a lot of time in this lecture that he gave in the 70s that Devi Mitra was there. We were just talking about it in the break. He was telling me how it happened. He spends a lot of time exploring just what we mean by that word experience. And he says usually we use experience in contrast to thought, especially abstract thought. Yeah. So we mean something direct and lived through, not abstractly thought about or fantasized. That's what we usually mean by experience. So he was then in the lecture, he was trying to say, well, in some ways you could think of Buddha as enlightenment as an experience, except for he says that there's no word in Buddhism that translates as experience. In fact, that in the early Buddhism, they don't seem to talk about it in terms of experience. And then he tries to talk about it in terms of non-experience, because enlightenment goes beyond, as I said in the first half, it goes beyond the physical senses and the rational mind. It's very easy to sort of go over that quite quickly. But the experience, to use that word, goes beyond the physical senses and the rational mind. So if the physical senses aren't in contact with things, then there can be no experience. You only have experiences when you're in contact with something, when you smoke a joint, or when you drink some coffee, or when you have sex, or when you go and see a film. You can have experiences because you're coming to your physical senses and your mind are coming into contact with things. But enlightenment is an experience that goes beyond the physical senses and the rational mind. So you can't, properly speaking, have an experience. The other point he makes is that experiences are something that you go through and come out the other end, and you then talk about your experience. So, guess what happened to me in New York, or guess what happened to me at that festival, or guess what happened to me. You talk about your experience, don't you, in that sort of way. But enlightenment isn't an experience you ever come out of. So that means it's a wholly different kind of thing that we don't really have a word for. Yeah. Anyway, that's all rather remarkable. But the main thing I want to stress tonight, just to get us going, is that enlightenment, whatever it is the fulfillment of being human. But that means that being human is a much deeper, more mysterious, much more remarkable thing than we easily imagine, because our lives are so much led outside of that that we forget that we've got this incredible consciousness. I mean, again, Marilynne Robinson said it's the most complicated object in the universe, as far as we know, the human brain, and we've all got one. She was saying that really needs us to pause over that. The most complicated object in the universe, so much so that you cannot simulate it, and we've all got one. You know, think of all the computer power doing all sorts of things, but we've got something more complex. So we don't have a place to step out of and look at the human like we can see an acorn or to an oak tree. We don't have a place to look at that. We don't have a God that looks down on us and says, here's what you're capable of. Buddhism says that at our heart, we want to fully express our nature, which is Buddha nature. And that nature goes beyond the rational mind. So that means that the rational mind is not going to be able to understand enlightenment. It's going to be might be able to do some useful preliminary work, and it's important, the rational mind, but enlightenment goes beyond it, and it goes beyond the rational, the physical senses. It goes into a realm that we can't even really call experience, because experience has to have a subject and an object. It has to have an experiencer and something experienced. And yet it fulfills our nature. Yeah. So what I want us to do for the last period of the evening, rather than worry about whether an enlightenment is an experience or a non-experience, which, you know, feels a bit technical, doesn't it? What we're going to be doing for the rest of the seminar is particularly looking at three particular areas, which I won't go into just now. But I thought we could finish by just perhaps in pairs or threes, not much more than a three. What experiences, have you had any experiences in your life which you can't account for? Now you might not think, were they an experience or a non-experience? Were they beyond the rational mind? I'm really working hard to get up to that sort of level of abstraction. I don't think like that. But I've definitely had experiences, undoubtedly had experiences, that I can't account for, that I struggle to be able to articulate. Now, do you think that actually is about something, or do you just think it was a, I don't know, a, you know, you had too much lunch, or you smoked too many you-know-whats, you know. Do you think that's onto something there? You know, because sometimes it's not that you might not have had an experience, because they can come and go, you know. And enlightenment's finally not about experience, really, in the way that we imagine the term, because of subject and object, space and time, and enlightenment transcends those categories. You know, my experience, particularly when I was very young, wasn't that I had an experience of there's something being beyond the rational mind and the physical senses, but I had a sense of being constrained by my life, painfully constrained by it. I felt the absence of it. So sometimes it might be not but that I've had these experiences that I can't account for, but it might be I felt provoked by the absence of that experience. I felt that my life isn't good enough. It doesn't fit. It's not what I want. I want to send it back. It's not. I think it could be much more than this. And you might not be able to articulate that in a nice way, but you might just think, I don't know, it's just rubbish. That's how I felt when I was a child in Henley and Ireland. I just wanted to smash it. You know, I just wanted to smash everything. I just thought, this is just rubbish. I thought everyone wasn't telling the truth. I didn't think. I thought it was rubbish. You know, I thought it's just not good enough. Now, it took me all of this time, and thank whatever you thank nowadays, that I came here to the Wednesday class when I was 25, because I was on a really quite destructive path by then. I just thought that life was rubbish, and I can still have my moments when I think that, and I think that there's even a truth in that. And it's to do with saying, well, no, this isn't a good enough. I want more to my life than that. So it might be that you experience more than, I don't know, some kind of transcendent experience. But let's just see whether there's anything in your direct experience, not in theory, including Buddhist theory, but in your direct experience that you're following up by being here tonight. Yeah? So let's just go into pairs or threes and spend a little bit of time talking about that, and then I'll finish again with a little bit of meditation and a poem again.